you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
I thought you might find it helpful, or at least interesting, to hear me kick around some of the thornier issues in career counseling with a fellow career counselor. I rarely do this. I normally feel like career counseling is something I can talk about. But, you know, I thought I'd be a little more ecumenical. And so I went on Yelp and found this guy who I had never heard of before. His name is Adrian Klapak, and I'm probably mispronouncing. Is that right?
You got it right.
Got it right. Miracles of miracles. Anyway, this is the Bay Area career coach who has the most five-star Yelp reviews, like 60-something, which is a lot. Anyway, so Adrian Klapak, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you so much for having me. I've read your book, Cool Careers for Dummies, listened to your podcast, and it's been really helpful in my work with clients.
Yeah, so it's very important to praise the host.
Absolutely.
That they always say that to the guests. Anyway, I want to kind of give a throw out this question, which has bugged me for a long time, and I'm really curious. Before I do that, off the air, you were telling me about some unusual training you had. In addition to standard, coaches training, institute training, You did something called Hakomi. And I said, what the hell is that? And give me an example of how this thing called Hakomi helps you with your career counseling clients.
Sure. So one example would be if a client is feeling stuck or held back from making a career change, very, very common experience and inevitability in career coaching. Instead of talking through it, I might say if it's appropriate for that client and it's appropriate for our relationship, why don't you get up and we physically stand up. And I might do something to represent that feeling of them being stuck, such as holding the back of their shirt in place and then asking them to move forward physically in the room. And I'll hold them in place as they're trying to move forward and then help them get in touch with what it feels like physically to be stuck, whereas in their career change, they're not physically stuck so much as emotionally stuck. And that physical stuckness in the room when I've got my hand on their shirt can help them get in touch with why they're really stuck and bring up emotions that they didn't have access to previously.
What that brings up for me is that the process of human change is not the linear rational, like a computer model where you can just reduce it to pure rationality. Human beings are driven forward or remaining stuck based on all kinds of, if you will say, irrational or emotional or even somatically based stuff. Is that fair?
Absolutely. But I think that people have really good reasons for getting stuck, for not doing things. So when we make the space for them to really explore why they're stuck and get to that deepest level, usually they're doubtful, they're afraid, and those doubts and fears have their roots in previous bad, for lack of a better word, experiences that they've had. So we need to help them work through those things. And it does make sense how our psyche, our systems, respond to not doing well on a test in second grade and being told that we're stupid or we're not smart, right? We carry that forward.
That's the childhood stuff. I've had a lot of clients who've had, as you say, a very realistic basis for fear and doubt. They've applied for a zillion jobs. They've been unemployed for 2 years. They get rejected. They feel that they're picked through merchandise. Any employer is going to say, why should I hire you when I could get somebody who's been continually employed and you've been unemployed for God knows how long, picked through merchandise. I don't care how well you interview. So they're filled with fear. How do you deal with that?
Well, we want to get to that core, belief of why they're afraid or why they think they're afraid. And I think usually it's one part of them that feels that they're not good enough or that they're afraid.
So do that with me. So, for example, I'm your client and I say to you, I'm scared. I'm burned out. I don't feel like I really don't have the motivation to move forward and apply for more jobs or network anymore because I've networked my butt off for a year, applied for dozens of jobs. In the beginning, I was enthusiastic. I thought, I'd get another job. But now after a year, I just can't make myself climb the mountain yet one more time. What do you do?
Right. Well, I'd start by saying, absolutely, I get why you're so frustrated. Right? I'd be frustrated, too, if I was in that position of trying and nothing was happening. And then maybe I'd go the route of trying to get you in touch with that enthusiasm you felt in the past. When else in your life have you faced a big challenge and had to persist through the fear and doubt? But probably I'd say that even this current instance of you feeling fearful and discouraged has its roots in something that happened a long time ago. So I'd help you feel that fear and disappointment and discouragement now and say, okay, Marty, you know, when in your life have you felt that in the past? What's familiar about it?
Okay. Let's talk about it. Again, dear listeners, when I am with my clients, I'm always looking to see glasses half full. But the radio talking about easy problems and things that solve easily is not going to get us to the really interesting stuff. So I apologize to you and to you, Adrian, by focusing kind of on the negatives, on the worrisomes, on the problems, because I think that's where we earn our money. So counselors and coaches have a long-standing reputation for encouraging, follow your passion, do what you love, follow your dreams. But when counselors and coaches encourage long-shot dreams, really, are they any better than fortune tellers intoning, you have a bright future? I mean, I've recently, and I just, in preparation for the show, I just went through the last 2 weeks of clients, that's all. And I've recently had clients who want to be a pro umpire, and there's 30 of them in the world, and even most college umpires don't make a living. I had another one who wants to be a sports agent, who's an average lawyer, but, you know, just an average lawyer. A woman who wants to sell dog paintings, and her dog paintings are just okay. Another client who wants to be a Broadway star, who's had, you know, okay roles in high school. And I had somebody who wants to make a living owning a horse ranch. So these, and they're not like superstar-driven, intelligent, well-connected people. They're just okay people. How would you handle such clients?
Yeah, that is tough. That's a good question. And I do think it's really important to support a client in their biggest dream, because I think it's those big dreams, those callings that we hear that offer the greatest potential for fulfillment. And even if the client doesn't actually get there to pro umpire or actress or whatever it is, if they're on the right path that inspires them, allows them to contribute their strengths, their passions, then there's likely to be some opportunities along the way that show up that they're able to, you know, craft into a sustainable career.
My original background was a medical researcher and as a statistician. So I think about it in a very different way. I almost feel like I'm guilty of malpractice when I see, say, an aspiring actor, and I know the odds are truly tens of thousands to one to make it, and the side paths are, they're not as rare, but they still hundreds to one against. And I know I'm an actor and a director, and I love that stuff. I love it to death. But I also know that there are thousands and thousands of would-be actors who went with bright-eyed bushy-tailed to New York or Hollywood, and then 3 or 5 or 8 years later, they come back with their tails between their legs, and now they're 30 or 35, and they are first starting their career and trying to convince some employer to hire them for a straight job, you know, even though they've been an actor for 10 or 20 years. I feel like I'm almost, unless they're really like the superstars at high school and college and they're at NYU or UCLA, I feel like I'm guilty of malpractice in the same way as a medical doctor who sees somebody and the person says, I want to smoke cigarettes. I really think it's a great idea. And the doctor says, it's okay, go follow your dream. That's what you want to do. It feels like it's an abdication of responsibility, a statistical primrose path I'm sending them down. You obviously disagree, because you say you want to support them in following their dreams, whatever.
Yeah, I do. I want to support them in following their dreams. I think I'd feel more guilty of malpractice if I was discouraging them or unsupportive to their dream. I think it's crushing for a person. I think it's a terrible way to live, to not follow our heart and do the thing that we really want to do. And if I'm going to help them pursue that big dream, that calling, I'm definitely going to help them try to figure out how can they do it in a sustainable way. If being an actress doesn't work out, what else can you be? Can you be growing, such as a career in teaching acting, or something else? But I think it's almost like, the way I see it is, we don't even have that much of a choice about what we do. Of course, we have a choice, but I think I want to help somebody figure out, like, who are they? What are their unique strengths? What are their passions? What's their personality? And what career fits? And then it's like, they claim that. They go and do it. They be who they are. It's less of choosing, like we're choosing something off the shelf. Which one do I want? What menu item do I want? It's more of a following of who we are. And I think that's just, that's the way to really contribute our uniqueness and live a fulfilling life.
As my guest, I want in each of these cases, while I push back a little, I want to give you the last word on each of these. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Adrian Klafhack. He is a coach of a very different stripe than I am, but I want, in the spirit of eclecticism, to expose you to very different approaches to the world of how to help people change. I guess I'll just briefly say my normal route would be to be very, you know, as coldly as cold as it sounds, letting them know about the odds and looking at their track record and maybe having them circle a date on their calendar a year or two from now. And if there aren't signs that they're going to make a sustainable living, you know, somebody's really paying them, not some teacher praising them, I then tell them to, you know, do you really, you know, of course the choice is up to you, but wouldn't a more likely approach to career happiness pursue your acting as a serious hobby like so many people do in love? And but, you know, you don't want to be homeless, you know. You would think that's killing their spirit.
If they come to that, if they try it for a couple years and realize, you know what, this isn't what I most deeply want, then fine, I'm going to support them doing it. But if they do it for a couple years, they haven't had the success in it they want, but they still want it and they're still committed to it, then yes, I'm going to support them. And I may raise, like you're saying, what else can you do, you know, or what else would support the life you want and allow you to act?
Yeah.
And,
but my clients are coming at a point where they're making a decision as to what to do for the next 2 years. And for me to just blithely say, I'm here to support you in your effort to follow your dream, feels very akin to that doctor who's encouraging somebody to smoke cigarettes when the odds are so terrible. Anyway, let's move on to another thing. I'm curious what you think about this. I'm going to tell you about a very specific client who I had this week. It's a related point, but these are very central, at least for me, and I like to think for my listeners. I have a client. He's got a bachelor's in creative writing from a UC, University of California, and he wants a career as a writer. I have so many of those type clients as well. But even his mother is in the writing field and hired him to do some writing. And she, after a year of, and this is a very loving, I'll just say, Jewish mother, you know, who really is very involved, after working with him relentlessly for years, she doesn't like his work. And so he's insisting, oh, I'm just not motivated. I really only want to write about fantasy and anime, which, again, there is almost nobody makes a living doing
right.
that. Right. And she doesn't believe that's his problem. She believes he's not really a good writer. And in addition, he's living at home and wants a survival job. But whenever he interviews, he's got Asperger's. And so whenever he interviews, he doesn't read social cues well. So even to the job interviewer, and let alone the job, he turns people off. So he can't even land a 10-hour job. So he is tearful, depressed, scared. All he wants to do is be a writer of fantasy. Even his mother, his loving mother, doesn't feel he's a good enough writer even to do the basic writing. And he can't even get a $10 an hour job. This is a real, absolute real client. What would Adrian Klafhack do with him?
Well, even though there aren't that many jobs in anime and fantasy, I think it may actually be more realistic that he goes and focuses on that specific niche because he's passionate about it, because he feels he has strengths in it, that he's probably more likely to connect with people in that realm than in anything else that he does, even if for somebody completely different than him, with a different set of skills, it could be more likely that they'd get an easier job somewhere else.
Okay. Of course, he has been trying for two. Nobody comes to a career counselor having not tried to follow their dreams by themselves. If they had made progress, he wouldn't need to see me and pay me money. He came to me because for the last 2 years he's been writing for free. He's writing a blog. He's been trying to make connections, and he's got zero. So,
well, then the other thing, the other thing I'd look for is what's the closest thing to fantasy and anime that maybe has more of a job market or more of a need in the world? Like, for example, the video game industry. Maybe there's a way for him to plug into that, and there are more jobs in that industry, even if it's competitive, but everything is. So I might expand still within the realm of his passions, but expand the scope of what he's looking for.
Okay, let's talk about a different kind of problem, career changing. You know, I have many clients in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and even 60s who are sick of doing whatever it is they're doing. Maybe they're sick of the, quote, straight job, accounting or whatever. Maybe they're sick of the arts. You know, they've been disillusioned by all their follow your dream stuff and they're, you know, homeless. I have a client who was an environmentalist and smart woman, and yet she tried for 20 years and she's on Section 8 housing. She has no health care, you know, disillusioned by the follow your dreams thing. Mm-hmm. In any case, but career changing is even more difficult because now you're in midlife and you're competing with somebody who's 20 or with a fresh degree and fresh skills. And what ends up so often happening is that when people change careers, they think that changing the career is going to change, make them happier, but they bring their problems with them. So if they're really not a good rigorous thinker, or they tend to be lazy, or they tend to have a or they have a drug problem or whatever, they will go to the new job. And after all that huge amount of work of the new training and having to convince employers that despite the fact they have no experience, they should be hired, that in the end, they're no happier. How do you deal with career changer coming into your office?
Well, what I'm always looking for, no matter what the age of a person, is the new career path that they're going to be transitioning into, is that aligned with their strengths and their passions, their personality, a sense of purpose, values, all those things that we look for? Because when it is, I've seen that people generally do tend to be much more engaged. They're able to use their strengths and contribute and be more successful. So it may not alleviate all of their problems, but I have seen that it does make a big difference if they really do land in a career that's right for them.
Dear listener, something absolutely true. You know, my Yelp reviews are nowhere near, they're good, but they're nowhere near as good as Adrian's. So in terms of being appreciated by the client base, you know, Adrian's approach has worked, that preternatural optimism, the preternatural support of the client doing what he or she thinks is right, is absolutely, clearly, empirically, the path to being more a more beloved career coach. So you're seeing a more, you know, you could call me realistic or curmudgeonly or statistically rational approach, clearly does not work as well with the population of human beings as Adrian's approach. Let's talk about networking. Everybody, the word that makes many career counseling clients vomit is networking, because again, they've usually tried it like hell for years, and then they don't have the gift of gab. They may not be physically attractive, so it's harder to network. They may be shy. They may be introverts. You know, they may have social anxiety, or that whatever it is, they just don't. It doesn't work. And then they come into our office, and traditionally, the career advice is it's important to network. Yeah. How do you deal with the person who's tried to network a lot unsuccessessfully, and do you tell them to network and teach them to network? What do you do?
Yeah, I'm going to try to help them figure out how to network in a way that works for them. So if they're not very socially fluent and able to work a room, then I'm not going to send them to a networking event where they'd be put in a situation to do that. Instead, what I'd do is maybe have them research people online, use LinkedIn, try to find specific people that they can connect with using starting with an email, which is much easier than a phone call or meeting someone in person, and then try to get an informational interview out of that where they're one-on-one. So that's what I do.
I agree with that too. We are living in a world that I don't know if you're finding. I've been doing career counseling 29 years now. And I'm finding that, you know, we've been telling people to do informational interviews for, you know, ever. And then, you know, when I first started, there was a reasonable response rate. If you sent, you know, 10 queries to somebody requesting an information interview, you'd get two or three. Now, you send 10, you're lucky to get one. People are busier. They're more overwhelmed. That informational interview technique, people don't believe it. They think you really just want a job. And, you know, so it's a lot harder. What do you do to motivate people to do the hard work, to network, to accept the low probability that somebody's going to respond, even if you write the cleverest, most personal query?
Right. Well, I always say start with people that you know, or that you know from one degree of separation. And usually, almost everybody I've worked with can find somebody to start with that they either know or is a friend of a friend. And then that gives them the confidence to reach a little bit further.
Mm-hmm. What about somebody comes in after a first session, you've given them a homework to network, you know, make a list of the people you really know well and the people one remove, both your LinkedIn connections and your more human connections. And, you know, you've worked out an approach, what they're going to be asking for and some sample questions that might fit. And they come in and they say they've done fairly little of their homework, or they reached a roadblock pretty quickly and then they felt stymied. Obviously, there's no one approach. You diagnose what's really at the root of,
yes,
of that. But how do you do that? How do you go about trying to unearth what's really the reason or reasons they didn't do their homework?
Well, I'll first ask them why didn't you do it? And they may say I'm busy. Yeah, and then I'd say, okay, so maybe those things were true, and let's imagine that they weren't true, that there was something else that was keeping you from doing this. You know, what might that have been?
Good question.
Mm-hmm. And see what they come up with. And mm-hmm. if they get to some doubt or fear, which I know is almost mm-hmm. always at the root of mm-hmm. why somebody doesn't do something, mm-hmm. then great, they've come up with it. If they don't, I might suggest, well, maybe you're feeling like or maybe you're feeling scared to reach out, that somebody may say no and you'll be rejected and you don't want to feel rejected. And if they grab onto that, then great, we go with that. And then it's great because if they're getting stuck with informational interviews, again, if we're at the deepest level, they're stuck on some deeper fear that's going to come out at some point in the process of them making a career change. So if we're getting to it now, then and they're able to work through it and be more free of it, then they're much likely to move forward on their own long after career coaching ends. So I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. And I noticed, you know, your constant use of getting to the psychological roots, the object relations, the family of origin issues or whatever. You know, I remember when we were trained, the trainers always made a point of telling us that we're not psychotherapists and that we really focus much more on the here and now and on the practical and uh-huh. the career stuff. Do you, I feel those are arbitrary distinctions, so I share your view about that. How do you ever have any fear that you're practicing out of the scope of your licensure, given that there is no licensure yeah. for coaches?
No, I don't have the licensure fear at all because there isn't one.
Well, I'm saying, could anybody accuse you or sue you of, you know, you're practicing psychotherapy on them when that's not you're not licensed to do so?
Right. Well, I'm not practicing psychotherapy, but what I'm doing is trying to be as helpful as I possibly can, and I've learned how to do certain therapeutic techniques that I think are incredibly valuable, and I don't really care what it's called as long as it's working for my clients.
Okay. As long as your clients aren't concerned about that. We live in a litigious society, but I gather you've never been sued.
No, I haven't. And I'm not a therapist, and I'm not claiming that I am a therapist. I've learned therapeutic techniques.
Okay.
You know, so I'll make that distinction.
All right, my dear listeners, maybe you'd like some therapeutic techniques as well as others from a really well-liked career coach, Adrian Klapak. I invite you to give us a call now. If you are stuck in, to use his word, in any aspect of your career, we'll give you two for the price of one because he is my guest. He will take first crack at it. And if he wants my support, to use the coaching term, I will be happy to support with a few words of my own.
Lovely.
So
the
phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While we're waiting for the calls to come in, let me move into another area. Motivation, you know, you've talked so much about fear. I'd like you to use some other technique. I don't want you to sound like a one-trick pony here.
Right.
Getting people motivated, it is hard work to find the right career or a right career. There is no one right career. There's many people careers. But taking the time to find a right career, doing the informational interviews, then landing the job, the resume, the cover letter, the preparing for the job interviews, gaining some skills, it's a project. And you're facing rejection or more often these days being ignored. What else other than getting to their core fears and emotions do you do to get people unlocked so that they're motivated to do that hard work?
Well, I'm always looking for fit. Does the new career that they want to pursue, does it fit who they are? Does it allow them to be who they authentically are? And when it does, then they know that they're going to be using their strengths, so they're more likely to feel confident in themselves, which is motivating. And then it has to be in something that they care about, that they're passionate about, and they're inspired to go and do. That also is motivating.
All right, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko with my guest, Adrian Klapak. What is your question for him?
Okay, is that me?
It is.
Okay. I'm age 64. I've been what I would call underemployed for the last 5 or 6 years because the company I worked for went out of business, just completely went under. And I've been contemplating just going for all my pensions and forgetting about it, which would be a fairly reasonable life. But I would like to work a few more years. I'd like to get in through the age 70 and max out, you know, the different retirement things. And I just want to do that. But I haven't been looking too hard. But something came up that I think would be mutually perfect for me and for the entity that's going to be seeking the employee. It's a company that's based in New York, They just did a major expansion in Washington, D.C., and now the new person who's been second in command is now number one in the organization, and they want to expand in locations around the country, including California and some other states. And they're looking for somebody, I think, who lives in a couple different worlds and who would have the contacts and the, you know, aptitude to get through the door to make the pitch to change one. It's actually a bank. Change their normal mainstream bank and go for this more, you know, uniquely positioned bank. And I think the selling would be pretty easy, and I think I could do it because it's what I did, you know, prior with the company that went under. And here's my specific question. And I'm working on some of this one degree of separation business of getting myself informed and getting through the bureaucracy there. And I've got to the assistant of the decision maker, and I'm set to talk to her next week. So things are in place, but here's my hang-up. Just call me a dinosaur if you want, but I've managed to, without any discomfort at all, wind up where I'm at in the modern world, 2014, and being like a big zero when it comes to social media. All right, I know it's out there. I know it's a big deal, but I don't care about it. I had no plans of getting into that whatsoever. But I've gotten through some of my contacts information that this decision maker is a big social media user. As a matter of fact, my contact said, you know, just send him a tweet. And I didn't say, yeah, right, sure. Mm-hmm. I have no, you know, I wouldn't know a tweet from a...
Right.
You know. So anyway, I'm trying to figure out how to do this. Should I go into some major crash course on social media, which I'm not, you know, and my tech aptitude overall is just kind of mediocre, but enough to get by all through my life up to now, you know, all the internet stuff.
So I think I understand
your email. So how do I spin this? Should I don't know if I should spin it, or one thought a friend said, tell the guy, hey, you've been sort of out of the market for a while, living the easy life. Now, I've actually been kind of frustratingly underemployed, but I could also say I've sort of been, you know, retired or semi-retired.
Let me interrupt and jump in, because there's some other callers here as well, and I want to answer your question. So what I'd say is I think it is a good idea for you to take some kind of crash course in social media so that you are familiar with it. But I definitely wouldn't say that you're an expert or it's your thing, so much as I'd frame it as I'm willing to learn it. If you genuinely are. And then the other thing I'd do is I'd highlight everything that you've learned and how you've grown when you haven't been doing social media. So I'm sure that you've had other experiences, maybe in building relationships with people or in putting deals together that your boss is going to want. So I'd be sure to highlight that as well.
And the one thing I would only, I agree with that. And the only thing I would add is one of the mistakes that job seekers make is that they put too many eggs in one basket. There are so many reasons why a job could not go to you for whatever reason. Maybe it ends up being they want a social media whiz, or maybe they're ageist and they don't want somebody who's 64. In the end, they see you and they want some 23-year-old who's a cutie who's going to go and do a better job or whatever. And what happens is if you put too many eggs in one basket, you end up being despondent. You put all your hopes into that one job, and if it doesn't work, that makes you even more inert. You said you haven't been that motivated. So if you say, you know, I noticed very carefully your wording, you know, it's not like you're dying to work. You say, well, I think I'd like to work these 6 years so I can get to my maximum employment benefits when I'm 70. I think you've got to, in whatever way, whether it be through your passion or some other benefits that you could derive from working, find the motivation to not put your eggs in one or two baskets, but it really requires a fairly systematic effort. Every study shows that normally it requires a large number of both front door inquiries, that is answering ads, and back door inquiries trying to get jobs through networking. And so if you're realistic at all about trying to get a job, you need to find whatever it is within you that's going to motivate you to put in the serious, usually few month long effort to land a job. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Except I am kind of putting all my eggs in one basket because I'm not really that motivated, I'll be honest. If this doesn't work out, I'll just muddle along like I am, and that's okay. So, you know, I hear what you're saying, but I just am what I am in this regard. And I do think, though, I am pretty uniquely qualified. There is not a big universe of people that have the package they need. You know, if I was in their shoes wanting to find this right person, I would definitely take a look at me.
Adrian, you know, has one more. I'm going to interrupt you again. You know, I notice you're on the radio, people normally have a pretty strong self-censor in terms of not talking too long. I'm worrying that if you were this long, you know, expansive in this phone call, that you could be that way in an interview. And there is a stereotype that older people tend to be long-winded, which could kill you even if you're well-qualified. So I would encourage you to use what I call the traffic light rule. During the first 30 seconds of an utterance, your light is green. People are listening. They're not thinking you're long-winded. During the second 30 seconds, they're starting to think, when will this guy shut up? And after 60 seconds, it's generally, wow, this guy is completely narcissistic and not interested in having a conversation. He's lecturing. So I'd encourage you to work on keeping things concise so that even if you are the ideal candidate for a job, you won't lose it because of some other factor like that.
Yeah, I'd probably plead guilty. I think I get your point.
Yeah.
And I hate being on the other end of such a dynamic. So, yeah, okay. Yeah.
One more thing I'll leave you with is, as Marty said, something about your enthusiasm. And I know you don't need this job. And I think it's really important that in the interview you do bring all that enthusiasm forward so somebody can get excited with you. And that tends to be contagious. And employers definitely want to feel that.
Yep. Anyway, I thank you very much for the call. We have lots of lines lighted up, so let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko with my guest Adrian Klapak, a fellow career coach. What is your question or comment for him?
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
Hi. Well, my name's Jerry, and actually I'm calling on behalf of my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
She recently left a position after working in banking for about 2.5 years, took some time off, travel, just wasn't happy with what she was doing. And during that period of time when she was traveling in Southeast Asia, came back from that trip very interested in going into the not-for-profit sector. Just got connected to a love of working with people that she actually experienced that working in the banking situation, but didn't really get a chance to fulfill that. Over a period of about really 3-4 months now, she's run into some just walls, getting able to, in terms of transitioning out of banking into the social service sector. And more recently, honestly, she's gone back to interviewing in banks. And my question is, I'm worried for her because I sense that she really wants to fulfill that passion for working for a social service organization, but because of the need to get a job, feeling that she needs that, and she built up some debt, she may go back into banking again and ultimately be as unhappy as she was when she left that position. So my question is, what kind of advice can I offer my daughter?
Adrian?
Yeah, I'd say that sometimes we do need to take a job that we don't really want in order to sustain ourselves in this world. We need money, but not to lose sight of that dream, of that calling that she has for doing something in social service. So while working for a bank, if she has to do that, I would say maybe go to a community bank if you can, something that's more aligned, or even explore microfinance if she hasn't already, to keep the dream alive and that she should continue to network and get involved in some type of volunteering, something in the nonprofit world to stay connected to that.
I agree with all of that, and there may be a way to actually use her more human values to help her get the right kind of banking job. I think his point is very good about maybe some community bank or whatever. But I also think that even in the most hard-nosed of banks, there's always a desperate need for a breath of humanity in even those hard-nosed places.
Sure.
So
yes.
That, for example, I'm involved for the first time in my life in litigation, and I hate it. I despise it. Hmm. But my lawyer is a kind guy. He's a litigator, but he is a kind, gentle man. And so if she brings the humanistic, you know, it wasn't lost on me that she came to these nonprofit values when she was in Asia. I can picture her in Nepal or whatever, Kathmandu.
Exactly.
You know, right? I know. Unfortunately, it's a common scenario. that you can bring that with you to every, even the most hard-nosed interaction with a coworker, with a customer, or whatever, and that may enable her to feel like she's fulfilling her mission, even on the job. And as Adrian says, on the side, you know, it's what I call the Bill Gates model. Bill Gates made zillions of dollars, you know, to selling software, but then he's donated $9 zillion to immunize every kid in Africa. Mm. So after work, there's still plenty of room to do, you know, the Zen-inspired activities that she that she's acquired.
Oh, you bet. Now, this is great. Yeah, this is actually great advice, and I know there are other callers, so I want to make sure they get in. But I really appreciate the advice you both offered. Thank you very much.
And we appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Let us go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Martin Emko, Adrian Klapak. What is your question or comment for him?
Are you referring to me?
I am.
Am I online?
Yes.
Oh. Hi, Marty. My name is Steven, and I'm a weekly listener. Really like your show.
Thank you.
Adrian, I appreciate you coming along for today.
Thank you.
My son is in a community college kind of getting his basic courses out of the way. And I know that you guys talk to a lot of people who are in midlife sort of career changing states or want to, you know, pursue another career. But it seems to me that your services would be very, very beneficial to young students who are looking to choose the proper career.
Sure.
And I've been motivating him to go after what he his passion is rather than the money. So I have three basic questions. And one is, what is your view, both of you, of course, what is your view on coaching a college student? And two, have you had many clients come to you that are just starting out in college? And three, what would be your strategy in coaching that particular student?
Adrian?
Yeah, I think coaching for college students is, it's an incredible opportunity in someone's life at that age to come and work with a coach. So I'm all for it. I've done coaching with college students, and my strategy is no different than anybody that I work with. Again, I'm always looking for, who is this person? What are their unique strengths and gifts? What are their passions? What sense of purpose, values, personality? And then trying to find a career that fits that. And more than anyone at any other age, they're in a position to, from the beginning, get the right training and education to support that. And then they have a longer chance of being able to grow it into a successful, sustainable career. So I think it's an amazing opportunity for anybody in college.
I agree 1,000%, except that I believe the right time to start is high school. I think that while the conventional wisdom is that you shouldn't choose your college based on a major, if in fact sometimes in high school you can still get clearer on some option that you never would have thought of, whether it be entomology or public administration. No kids, when they grow up, they know doctor, lawyer, nurse, whatever. But if you can find some quintessentially well-suited niche at the high school level, you can then choose a college that at least has the option, has that major. Of course he may change majors, but at least if there's some chance he won't change majors, and so it's a great opportunity to get him hooked in to the right training up front. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's great that you're supporting him in doing this and encouraging his passions. I think that's amazing.
I also think there's huge advantages in a young person doing this, because when a kid asks for an informational interview, much more likely to get a yes than from 45-year-olds.
So true.
That we all feel sorry for the kid. Oh, there's an emotional poignancy that accrues. And the other thing, you asked about strategy. You know, when I'm dealing with a 45-year-old with a mortgage and a spouse who's clamoring, get back to work or I'm going to divorce you, which really does happen a lot, really, in the trenches, when you're unencumbered, you have all the options. You don't have to be as short-term focused in terms of length of training, in terms of how practical you have to be.
Yes.
You're in a position to take a long-shot risk. If I have a 17-year-old who says he or she wants to try to be a Broadway star, and that, you know, I'm much more likely to be truly supportive of that at 17 when a person's unencumbered, when they're 40 and they were in banking and they can't stand banking anymore and so they want to go and be an actor, you know, but he or she has got this mortgage. So there's nothing better than a teenage client for both the coach as well as for the kid.
Yes, and yeah, I think some sort of career coaching. I know that schools have counseling departments, but I feel like I want to make it cool for high school students and for college students. Cool and okay, and just not even okay, like what is done, that everybody goes to see a career coach or career counselor in high school and in college. I think that that needs to happen.
But Adrian's point is great, because sometimes the career counseling at the high school career center is awesome because they have all these resources that are right there, and the kid is right there, and he doesn't feel like he's weird going to a private career coach. It feels more normal. So, and you're not spending money. So my way would be, whether the kid's in high school or college, to have him start for free. Let him go and play. For example, if you just search either, even if the kid has a crappy career center, having him start at America's Job Centers is an amazing amalgam of amazing self-assessments and career information and everything else. Start there. That also is more empowering for the kid, because the kid is taking more control of the situation rather than surrendering some power to this coach. Start there. If the self-study on the American Job Center doesn't work, then see if there's useful career counseling or coaching or resources at the high school or college career center. And then if that doesn't work, then it's excellent use of money, in my judgment, to then see the career coach.
Yeah, I agree. I think that one stop, the America's one stop, it's great that it's there, and it can be horribly overwhelming and out of fit for certain clients. So if that's discouraging for you and you're listening, don't give up. Do seek out, you know, the free career counselors you have at your school.
And that's a great role for
him. I think it's good for him to pursue all resources. But I think one of the things that you guys bring is the reality of specific jobs that of what they entail, and jobs that are not common amongst the other resources, which may match his particular skills and talents, and maybe shed some light into careers that he never even thought of, or they're not even being mentioned in these other resources.
Yeah, that's a number of clients said. I want to build on Adrian's point, though. He's right that many people would find America's Job Centers because there's so many great choices. It's overwhelming. That's a great role for a parent. What a wonderful supportive role to sit down with your kid on that and, you know, have a Coke with him or something healthier, green tea, and, you know, but sit down with him and or her, of course, and you know, be the shepherd, be the guide. I don't believe in running to professionals too quickly. It really is, not only for the money, but there is an empowerment that comes from saying, damn it, I don't need to have this therapist, I don't need to have this. If it's necessary, yes, but that should not be the method of first resort, in my judgment. Anyway, okay. I thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Adrian Klapak. He's got the most positive Yelp reviews among career coaches, better than me, I don't mind admitting it. And so it's a pleasure to have him on to have two for the price of one, but especially him. So let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. And Adrian, what is your question or comment for him?
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My name is Don, and I think a major problem I have in advancing in my job is lack of confidence. You know, nervousness about sending an email, nervousness about speaking up. And in fact, if I were given, you know, questions about a promotion, reasons I deserve the promotion or reasons I shouldn't have a promotion or another job, I'd find it easier to answer the one on why I shouldn't get another job or promotion than to answer why I should. And I see that as a problem. I don't know if you have any recommendations of techniques to overcome that.
Okay, he presents the problem as one of lack of self-confidence. How would you react in that situation?
Well, I'd say that it sounds like, Don, one part of you feels unconfident. So what I'd try to help you do is get to know that one part of you that feels unconfident and try to understand, you know, what, if anything, its positive intention is for you, like what it's trying to do for you by pointing out the ways in which it thinks. Again, this part of you thinks that you can't do or aren't as good as somebody else for a certain job. So I'd help you, I'd frame it as one part of you feels you're unconfident, and I'd help you try to get to know that part and build a new relationship with it.
And I have a different approach. I wouldn't, because there is lack of confidence is a symptom. It's like a headache. A headache can be caused by a brain tumor, it can be caused by a migraine, it can be caused by tension, it can be caused by, you know, some idiopathic causes. No, we don't know what the causes. the lack of self-confidence to me is just a symptom. Sometimes it really reflects the fact that you're not competent, that the reluctance to send the email is because your logic is not rigorous enough, you don't have enough understanding of the banking and financing rules, so you're afraid, you know, you've had a track record of missing the point and getting bad feedback on speaking up or whatever. So that would be called the rational lack of self-confidence, that you're in the wrong job, you need either more training or you need another job. Then there's the irrational kind of lack of self-confidence, where really if there was a god or the goddess looking down upon you, the god or goddess would say, yes, you are, you know, you may not be the best rock star in the whole world of banking and finance, but you're good enough so that it's your email is worth sending, you're worth speaking up. Which of those two flavors of lack of self-confidence do you really believe is operative in your case, Don?
Irrational, clearly irrational, because if I go back to job history, I'm often right.
Great. And so let's play a little game. So let's say you're playing shrink with yourself. What do you believe is the true psychological root for that irrational lack of self-confidence?
That's a great question. And I'm not sure the answer.
Multiple choice. Which of the following feels most correct? Your parents telling you you were dumb, which is something Adrian had mentioned in an earlier context, that you are afraid that you're not as good as you used to be, you're getting older, and therefore you're not quite as on the case. You feel that you are unworthy, you did something bad in your life, and you feel guilty and not worthy of success. Do any of those have any resonance at all as to the root cause for the irrational lack of self-confidence?
Well, the irrational lack of self-confidence I recognized from when I was in elementary school.
Okay. Do you remember a concrete basis for that, or you were just maybe a crappy student in elementary school and that you've generalized from that you're going to be crappy your whole life?
No, I was a good student.
Okay.
And I scored well on ACT and SAT, so it's not that one.
Okay.
Frankly, I find that people often seem too confident. I mean,
right.
It's maybe a whole perspective. Like,
good point.
Somebody thinks that, oh, I'll be great for a job, and I think, no, you won't. So it may be a different view of reality.
Good point. I want to build on that before we let Adrian talk about it. Really, we live in America is the land of self-esteem, where building self-esteem is primary. As Garrison Keillor said, he said, we live in a world where everybody's above average, where by definition, in fact, 50% of people are below average. And there are studies that find that the people with the highest self-esteem often are the lowest achievers. There was a study that came out of Cornell last year that found that they're not smart enough to realize how little they know. And it may be you're absolutely right, that you are smart enough to realize that there are so many ambiguities in your email and you can't be that right because there's a lot of unanswered questions. So what if I said, and I remember Abraham Lincoln being tortured by self-doubt, if I said that what you need to do is embrace your lack of self-confidence as a plus, to say that that is the appropriate measured self-criticism that is essential for excellence. And so in your emails, acknowledge, you know, this is a gray area, I'm not sure I'm right about this. Bring in that nuance so that you can be really, you know, then you're going to be a far better person and a better email than if you try to feign this self-confidence. What do you think?
I think that's very good. In fact, going back to the email example, my fear isn't that I'm wrong in the email. My fear is that, let's say, my supervisors or the other people may not realize I'm right.
So how could you reframe the way in which you write it? Either that or run it by, sometimes if it's an important email, you could run it by your boss or whatever in advance so you can present the more nuanced thinking that went into it so to maybe get their buy-in before you've committed it to writing. Or insert the nuance into the email itself. Do either of those two feel like worthy options?
They're both worthy options. In my particular case, the first won't work because my boss who once told me I lack confidence and should sort myself more. He wouldn't be into that because he'd almost maybe find it as a lack of self-confidence. But on the other hand, I've noticed sometimes when I've asked his opinion first, he loves it.
So just something to muse upon on a situation-by-situation basis. Adrian, do you have something you want to add to this?
Yeah, one thing that I was hearing is it sounds like you have a really high standard of quality or of excellence, that doing something very well is important to you. And I would say that sometimes that's a good thing. That can help us produce something of great quality. And other times it gets in the way, like you might be feeling right now with this self-confidence issue. So you may just sort of remind yourself that even if you contribute something that isn't perfect, or isn't as good as it could possibly be, that it's still going to be valuable.
That's good, yes.
And one more shot at this, which is the perspective issue. And I fail at this miserably myself, so I realize it's a lot easier to say than to do. But keeping in the larger, in perspective, the larger scheme of things, how important is that this email be absolutely airtight? How important is it that even the result of that email, you know, will, how much will humankind be affected by it? How much, even on a more basic level, will your job be affected by it? So maybe, just maybe, and I really do a terrible job of this, but keeping in mind...
By the way, the answer to all those questions was negligible.
Okay. And so would it help to keep, try at least to keep that in mind, that the import of the email or speaking up at the meeting is far less than perhaps you're unconsciously ascribing to it?
I think that's an excellent point.
Okay. I will thank you. I'll quit while I'm ahead. Thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko. I'll give out the phone number one more time. If you or someone you love, as some of our callers have been, are unhappy, unstuck, especially in a career, specifically in a career-related area, you've got two career counselor types, coach types here to try to help you. My guest is a special one, Adrian Klapak. He's got an amazing number of 5-star reviews on Yelp. So, and we have somewhat of a different approach to things. So you're going to get two different perspectives. So this is a great time to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, for a workover with no pummeling involved. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Before we go back to the phones, I have peppered you with questions in the first half of this interview. Is there anything you would like to ask me as a fellow, you know, colleague, as a fellow career coach?
Absolutely. Yes. One thing I'd really like to know the answer to, or your thoughts on, is when you've worked with a client for several months and you've done all the self-discovery and assessments and career explorations, and they still can't find a career that they want to pursue, what do you do?
Really, I think one of career counseling's dirty, dark secrets is it's based on the assumption that there is this magically perfect fit career, that if you find it, you're going to be happy. And unless you do, unless you have something that gives you a career orgasm, you're going to be unhappy. I really do like to use the sexual analogy. For most people, you get orgasmic about a career only after you've gotten into it.
Mm-hmm.
If you see a beautiful, attractive person across the room, unless you're maybe 13 or 14 years old, you're not going to have an orgasm just looking at him or her across the room. You've got to approach the person, talk to the person, get to know them, kiss them, and little by little, then things happen. It's that way with most careers. Off the shelf, you mention a career, or they've thought of careers, and nothing gives them the orgasm. They have this unconscious belief that it's supposed to hit them like a bolt of lightning, that when mm-hmm. they find it, it's going to be eureka, I have found it.
Yep.
Teaching them that model that you know, after probably years of exploration before they came to the career counselor, and in my case, frankly, I send them a very long, very probing new client questionnaire before they even come in to help inventory their skills, interests, values, etc. So very often on session one, we've already, by the end of session one, which is a 2-hour session, they have a very clear sense of what their relative strengths and weaknesses are, so and what careers might fit. But at whether it be after one session or 10 sessions, at some point, if they're still not finding that eureka, I have found it, I urge them to pick the thing that feels the best for starters. The metaphor I use is that of being dropped on from a helicopter on top of a frigid mountain. If you stand up at the top of the mountain looking which of the 10 paths to go down, you're going to freeze and die before you can get down there. It's far wiser to take a quick look at all of the viable possibilities and start down the path. If it turns out to be a sheer icy cliff, you can scramble back up to the top. If it's wonderful, a nice clear meadow, you go down. Or maybe you go down and then you see the aforementioned side path that you can take. But do not sit on the sidelines for very long, because you're going to be waiting for Godot and freeze to death. So that's how I deal with the issue of their not having come up with something.
I love those thoughts. I think that's great advice.
Got any more questions?
I do. What is the worst career advice you could think of?
I really do think it's the unbridled follow your passion, I got to be honest.
Mm.
I've seen it fail many, many, many more times. And the rationale that even if you don't get all the way there, that getting part way there is worth it is I think, fallacious, because very often it doesn't accrue, because their dream of being this broadcaster or dream of being this artist or dream of being this writer rarely comes up with side paths that are sufficiently – and I am the least materialistic guy in the world, so not like I'm saying you got to make a lot of money. But even to be able to survive, to pay your rent on a crappy apartment and get health care, people who choose follow your passions, most people's passions – devolve into a relatively small number of them, and those are tend to be the most long shot, and therefore I think without really due providing cautions and real getting them to really look at the probabilities, I think is the quality of passion is the worst career advice I can imagine.
And then what about the discouragement that goes along with
great point, you can immediately build them up by pointing up that there are many jobs that ostensibly aren't cool careers that nonetheless yield to great happiness. That if I filled a room with 100 people who are happy with their career, 98 of them would not have known they would have been happy had they until they went into it. And yet you look at all the actors and musicians and writers, look at their suicide rate, look at their drug abuse rate. They're not any happier. True happiness in a career is not a function of following your career passion. It's generally having the basics, a boss you respect, an ethical workplace, reasonable job security, learning opportunities, fun coworkers, a reasonable commute. In the end, if you fill the room with all the people who are happy with their careers, most of them would say it is those are the factors, although they're not sexy, that really end up being more largely contributory to their being happy with their career than whether they were in an ostensibly cool career.
Got it. It's good to hear your perspective on it.
Got one more question for me before we go to take another call?
Yes, I do. If you had to boil all of your career advice into one sentence, as succinctly as you could possibly put it, what is that?
Work is primary. Be laser focused. I'm going to cheat on the one sentence. But work is – but when you die, in the end, your value on this earth is how much you've contributed. And contribution can occur in anything from being a good dishwasher to being a good rock star. All work is worthy, and in order to get it in this terribly these terribly difficult times, it does, in my mind, require laser focus. Pick something, whatever it is, even if it's not going to give you an orgasm up front, and really do everything you can in your own way to land the job. Some people, as you say, are great networkers. They should be networking in person. Others couldn't do it in writing. Others are going to be great at answering ads. Others are going to be doing it by going back to school because they do school better than they do life. Do it whatever way is yours, but pick something and then go after it with absolute laser focus as though you were really passionate about it. And if you do it that way, you will probably grow to be passionate about it. We have almost, you know what? We have almost no time, so I shouldn't do that. I can't go back to the phones. What I want to do is I want to give you one more question just for – what was the question you wished that I would ask you that we didn't have a chance to get to that you would like to share with our listeners?
Wow,
or what is the one
question.
Thing? Forget about what is the one thing you'd like to – let's make it simpler. What's the one thing briefly in 30 seconds or so that you would like to share with our listeners that you haven't yet said?
So what I'd like to share is when thinking about what career is right for you, I think the most important thing you can do is really get to know yourself, get to know who you naturally are, what your natural strengths and gifts are, your passions, your personality, and then go and do who you are, do what you are. That's my advice.
Let me ask you for one more 10-second question about Adrian, the human being. If you were coaching yourself right now, what would be the one change you would make in your life?
I'm a perfectionist, and I'm too controlling, and I would somehow, and I am trying to let go of the tightness of control around my business, so that I could really go and do something bigger that has a really big contribution on helping so many more people in high schools and colleges find a path that fits them.
So delegating, doing the online training program that you're developing, doing some other things like that, so you're not chained to your chair.
Absolutely.
And I want to thank you very much, Adrian Klapak, for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. His name is spelled weirdly, so if you want to find him, it's K-L-A-P-A-K. H-A-A-K. Google him. You'll find him. You'll see those Yelp reviews. It intimidated me, to tell you the truth. It's pretty awesome. He's got a very different style than I do, but he's very beloved. There's no question about that. Anyway, that's Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and your great call and questions. I love you, dear listeners, I swear. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do three-minute workovers. Sometimes they're 10, whatever. Workovers on callers. And I will talk with Connie Brock. She runs ProMatch in Silicon Valley. It's one of the nation's most successful job search support groups. An average of 15 of its members land a job each month. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.